Tonight on Banfield, 52 days after the Idaho quadruple murders, authorities have their one and only suspect right where they want him. He is in Idaho right now. Brian Koberger gets a no-frills, maximum security, single-engine plane ride from the state where he was born to the state that just may put him to death. Let the prosecution begin. Also tonight, we are a very long way from a trial, but the facts are set and a whole lot of evidence is in. That just leaves the arguments, the explanations, the wiggle room, and the benefit of the doubt. And that is where the lawyers come in. Tonight, two of the very best will make their very best cases for and against Brian Koberger. And then unfulfilled wishes, untraveled roads, so much unfinished business in the lives that were ended in Moscow, just as they were truly beginning. This hour, we will remember those lives and our collective loss with one of the victims' own words. And it is all straight ahead in this special hour of Banfield. Hello and welcome to our breaking news coverage of the Idaho quadruple murder case. Just minutes ago, the only known suspect arrived back where the massacre happened 52 days ago. Brian Koberger just landed, not in Moscow, Idaho, but ironically in Pullman, Washington, just across the state line where he's a doctoral student in criminology. It was a very, very long day on a very small plane. And our Brian Enten is now live at the Latah County Jail, where Koberger is most likely, I don't know, getting booked, getting fingerprinted, settling in, getting a new jumpsuit. Because Brian, he literally just walked into the facility where you are wearing Pennsylvania jail jumpsuit clothing.
He did about 5 minutes ago. Man, I just ran over here from the airport. I barely made it. You mentioned it. It's been a busy day. It's been a busy half an hour. That plane touching down at the Pullman Moscow airport about 15 minutes from here. You said it right across the state line in Washington state. The plane pulled around. It was a single engine prop, which is why it took almost 10 hours for them to get here today. They had to make two stops between Pennsylvania and Washington to refuel. And you can see right there, there he is. Brian Koberger walked off the plane, looked like he had body armor on. He was still in that same red jumpsuit that he had on in Pennsylvania when he left this morning bright and early at 6 o'clock. They walked him over there to what looked like a pickup truck, a sheriff's office pickup truck. They loaded him in and then off he went, the 15 minute drive here to the jail behind me. The jail here, remember, this is a small town, Ashley. The jail is small. It is underneath the courthouse. Just 30 or 40 cells. They've never really had a situation quite like this before, but they brought him in here. The door opened at the Sally Port behind me. In he went, and he is now in the jail here in Moscow, Idaho.
Could you tell, Brian, who was escorting him, whether it was marshals, FBI, Idaho officials, Pennsylvania officials, whether they did the transfer from one jurisdictional authority to the other? Was it hard to tell given what they were wearing?
It was hard to tell, but I am told for sure 100% there was at least one FBI agent on the plane. We don't know if anyone from Idaho traveled out to Pennsylvania to also be on the plane. But what was interesting, it was a Pennsylvania State Police plane. You know, we'd been talking about this for days, thinking that it was going to be a jet, an FBI jet, or the U.S. Marshals. They were going to get here in 3 or 4 hours. That did not happen. It was such a long day because it was that small, slow plane that had to refuel two times en route. And they used the Pennsylvania State Police plane to bring them all the way here to Idaho.
Okay, then what about these stops that he made? Rapid City in South Dakota, but also before that in Indiana, which, by the way, let's discuss the irony of the fact that he was stopped in Indiana twice on the way across the country to spend Christmas with the family. And then the plane that was bringing him back to face four first-degree murder charges actually landed again in Indiana to refuel, I think it was, right?
Yeah, two refueling stops today. The first one that you're talking about, we do have some pictures. We actually had some video there, too, of the plane landing. We've been tracking this plane all day. I mean, it's been crazy, Ashley, trying to figure out where it's been going all day long when they make these stops. So stopped there. He actually got off the plane during the first stop. Went into the building. Don't know if it was like a bathroom situation or whatever. They refueled the plane. Up they went again. And then they made a second stop before finally making it to Washington State, right over the border from where we are in Idaho.
Yeah, let me correct myself there. He stopped in Illinois on the way back. That's important to know. Yeah. A big difference
there.
Yeah,
it was near Champaign, Illinois. Yeah.
And that plane, single engine, which I think only has, I'm trying to remember the stats on it, but I think it's only about 1,800 miles that it can travel, maybe 1,700 miles. It might have just been like 100 miles or so nautical miles off from being able to make that trip. But isn't it strange that it made two touchdowns? And by the way, what about the security for people who were in those private airports where they had to land?
Well, I mean, they had to do it. I mean, this is the plane they chose to use. Again, this caught us totally off guard. I thought they were going to fly in a jet and be here nonstop. I didn't think I was going to make it rushing here from Pennsylvania. But, I mean, it took them the whole day because they took this Pennsylvania State Police plane. In terms of the security at the airports, I mean, they had him shackled. There was law enforcement with him. Clearly, he wasn't armed or anything like that. So I don't think that was an issue. We don't actually think he got off the plane necessarily at the second stop. But it was an all-day affair.
Well, I'm just looking at something here saying that he apparently, when he went into the airport building, was very small in Illinois. He had to use the bathroom in there, and they cleared it. They cleared employees. They cleared passengers. They cleared anybody who had to be in that building, because if you have an accused quadruple murderer in shackles coming in to use the restroom, it would stand to reason that you might not want any people, anybody who might know he was going to land there, to be present. But they did that. That was at least one security measure that they took. Brian, don't go anywhere. I want you to keep me updated about any movements of any personnel behind you, because you just never know. Maybe his lawyers are going to show up, right? Tonight, he's going to have to, at some point, get briefed on what his first appearance is going to be, and that could come as early as tomorrow. Of course, the most fascinating part of that, Brian, was going to be the affidavit. We were hoping for that today. Likely tomorrow, right? If he makes his first appearance tomorrow, that's when we get the cascade of information.
Yeah, that's what we're thinking now. We thought maybe it was going to happen this afternoon, but then when we saw how long it was going to take for that plane to get here, clearly not happening tonight. So we're thinking first thing tomorrow morning.
Yeah, they don't often have night court, you know, in small towns like Moscow, Idaho.
Yeah.
But listen, thank you for the hustle. I know you had to hightail it from the airport all the way to the jail where you are right now. But thank you so much for this. Brian Enten, live for us. Don't go anywhere. We're going to get an update in a little bit. But just before the flight that Brian has been reporting on just now, 6 o'clock this morning, he was awakened in a fairly uncomfortable cell in Pennsylvania. He was taken out of that cell. He'd been there for the past 5 days awaiting this flight that he took. He was loaded onto that single-engine 11-seat plane owned by Pennsylvania State Police. A few hours later, plane made the pit stop in Champaign, Illinois, as Brian reported, apparently fueling up, allowing the suspect to use the restroom. Some photos were snapped, actually, by TMZ, and they show Koberger surrounded by armed officers. This is the daylight, right? You just saw him in the same jumpsuit at night, having landed on the, in the western part of the country there in Pullman, Washington. But these are the daytime photos midway, mid-trip, as he was walked from the plane and into FlightStar, that's that private airport, and then loaded back onto the plane as well. Once again, I can tell you this, TMZ said that that place was completely cleared of other passengers and employees while Koberger was inside. All right, so this is something I want to tell you about. I just got off the phone a little bit ago with a source who gave me some pretty remarkable information about what Koberger was doing in this jail where he was at. That picture with him in the suicide smock, you can only see the top of it. Some people think it's like a Kevlar vest. It's not. It won't resist stabbing or shooting. Nothing like that of the sort. It's more of like a heavy, heavy quilted fabric that can't be rolled into a, kind of a sheet roll where you could hang yourself. It's called a suicide smock for a reason. That goes all the way down to just below sort of the pelvis, between the knees and the pelvis, almost like you're wearing a mini dress. And that's all you get. If you're on suicide watch, as he was for the 5 days, you get to wear that. And you don't get a T-shirt, you don't get underwear, you don't get anything else that can be fashioned into any kind of device where you can hang yourself. And that's how he spent his 5 days. But he did get a shower every day, I'm told, by a source. And the shower was about 20 yards down a hallway, so he would be marched in his leg shackles. He was not allowed to take the leg shackles off while he was marched down that hallway to the showers every day. They did release the handcuffs so that he could wash himself, but that's about the only time they allowed him that, that latitude. And then he'd be marched back into his cell, and he was able to get a fresh set of the suicide smock if he wanted one. Now, here's what's super fascinating. In the intake part of that jail, there are five cells. Three of them have doors and two of them have bars. He was in one of the ones with the doors, and the doors, the one he was in, is all glass. It's got a middle portion that's all frosted, and that's the only privacy you get, because when you sit on the stainless steel toilet, that is the only bathroom you're going to use while you're in there, it has a faucet above it. That's the only privacy, is that little bit of frosted glass across the middle of the glass door that was the front of his cell. But basically, there's a lieutenant or guards who can watch him at all times, and do watch him at all times. He gets a 15-minute checkup just to make sure everything's going on okay. But if he's lying down on the floor, they can see him below the frosted glass. And if he was standing up, they could see him above the frosted glass. He did request the vegan meals, so he was given meals that would satisfy that kind of diet. And I'm told it's peanut butter and jelly, applesauce, vegetables, beans, rice, cereal, maybe some potatoes. That's about it. I am also told that the impression from some of the folks in the jail was that he looked, and I'll use the word, creepy. Right from the start, they said he looked extremely creepy. Here is something that is fascinating. He did talk. He actually said a couple of things that are pretty astounding, and I'm assuming that his defense attorneys will probably want to know this, as well as the prosecutors. When he was asked, why did you do it? His answer was, I didn't do anything. When the follow-up question was, why did you go to Idaho? His answer was, the shopping is better in Idaho. Let me repeat that. When Brian Kober was asked, why did you go to Idaho? He answered, the shopping is better in Idaho. I'm assuming that's a joke, but we are dealing with a quadruple murder here and four first-degree murder charges that he's facing. I don't find that very funny. Let me tell you a couple of other things about the way he spent his time there. He was not allowed. He's an alleged murderer at this point. Let's be very clear about this. He's going to face his process in Idaho, but he was not allowed any reading materials. He was allowed no pens, no paper. At no point was my source aware of any crying or any praying or any sadness, which is odd. He seemed as though he slept most of the time. He wasn't loud and he was not mean. That is also in direct, opposition to a report that came out in a newspaper saying that he was screaming profanity and rap lyrics and exposing himself. That was another inmate, actually, in the same intake area. That happened with someone completely different. It was not this inmate. This inmate was a model inmate who caused no problems. And even though he was cold, because he was only wearing that suicide smock you're seeing, and had no sheets, no blankets, only the mattress, and that's a cold area, that intake area is quite cold. There's a lot of electronics equipment in there, so they have to keep it fairly cool. He didn't have a blanket, a suicide blanket, the first night or two, but he did have one later on. Here's one other thing that happened. Another inmate came through that inmate intake area and yelled at him, gave him the finger and yelled at him, F you, I'm going to kill you. That's what another inmate yelled at him, F you, I'm going to kill you. And of course, Brian Koberger was behind a locked glass cell door and didn't have any response that we know of at that point. There's some of the reporting I can give you from the jail cell where he spent 4 or 5 days up until 6 o'clock this morning. All right, so speaking of Pennsylvania, night before Brian Koberger ended up in that cell, the night before the raid on his parents' home where he was staying for Christmas, take a look at this. Kind of looks like somebody was getting a really good look at that home from above. This literally popped up on our radar today. It is an animated image of the air traffic above the Koberger home in eastern Pennsylvania last Thursday night, just hours before that arrest and raid. This comes from an application called Flight Radar 24. And those green counterclockwise loops that you're looking at depict an aircraft without the usual identifying markers. And it circled for about 2 hours. 2 hours above the Kohberger's home. We don't know who. We don't know why. Although it is fair to assume, since it's now been reported that he was under surveillance for at least 4 days in that home, that it was likely authorities keeping an eye on him. And we don't know whether or how a plane could possibly fly over the same spot for 2 hours without alerting him, but the arrest seemed to go off without a hitch. Back to Idaho now. Kohberger is going to face 4 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of felony burglary. And that, my friends, is a far cry from his last encounter with the Latah County law enforcement. Are you ready for this? Back in August, just a few months ago, he was only facing a seatbelt violation, an infraction that cost him $10 when he failed to appear in court. A few weeks ago, and that's obviously a little over a month after the murders, Kohberger and his father were pulled over twice by the police in Indiana. They were driving back to Pennsylvania from Washington State University, where Kohberger lived and studied. Yesterday, we showed you police body cam footage from the second of those 2 stops. That was the second stop. It was for speeding. But tonight, we've got the footage from the first stop, the one where they were pulled over for tailgating. I want you to look and have a listen to the conversation.
Hello.
How you doing?
How y'all doing today? Good, good. Take a look at your driver's license real quick if I could. See, he's right up on that van, man. He was right up on the back end of that van. Pulled you over for tailgating. Is this your car? Okay. Cool. Where are you headed?
Well, we're coming from WSU.
All right, now I want you to watch as they tell the officer about what they consider a scary incident that they just left behind out west where Brian lives, and it's not what you think.
And what did you say about some SWAT team thing?
Or yeah, there was a mass shooting here.
Where?
Could you hear that? Could you hear that last thing? Kohberger told the officer there was a mass shooting at WSU, Washington State University. His father called it horrifying. In fact, there was indeed a shooting. It was not a mass shooting, and it was at Washington State University, and it did happen on the same day as this traffic stop, which, by the way, was December 15th. 8 days before that, police in Moscow put out the first alert for the car that the Kohbergers are driving in, a white Hyundai Elantra. Was the Indiana officer suspicious? He asked them a lot of questions about where they were going and the shooting in Washington. Was this just a ruse, a means of keeping the track going on Kohberger, or maybe to slow him down? Or was this just a bizarre coincidence that they were pulled over twice within about an hour on that 2,500-mile trip across the country? Many of the answers we're searching for should be revealed, finally, when police reveal the affidavit that outlines all the reasons that they went right for him, arresting Kohberger in the Idaho students' murders. News Nation correspondent Nancy Liu has more.
Ashley, whenever he gets to Idaho, Brian Kohberger will be served with the arrest warrant and then the highly anticipated unsealing of the probable cause affidavit. Kohberger will face justice for allegedly taking 4 young lives. They were living their best lives. Kaylee Gonsalves, Maddie Mogan, Zana Kernodal, and Ethan Chapin having a blast attending the University of Idaho until their brutal murders on November 13th.
How are you feeling?
After waiving extradition to Idaho, their accused killer left the Monroe County Jail in Pennsylvania early this morning. Brian Kohberger is apparently eager to see what's in the probable cause affidavit here in Idaho.
I definitely believe that one of the main reasons the defendant chose to waive extradition and hurry his return back to Idaho was the need to know what was in those documents.
Today, the release of more new body cam video of Koberger driving the white Elantra linked to the case.
Right up on the back end of that van, pulled you over for tailgating.
Koberger's defense already underway. His Idaho public defender had reps at the murder scene before his Pennsylvania court hearing, and a Latah County judge has issued a non-dissemination order. It prohibits all law enforcement, attorneys, and just about anyone connected to the case from speaking to the public or media. Prior to that, the Latah County sheriff told News Nation that there will be increased security at the local jail in Moscow.
Ethan was a terrific kid, just an absolute light in this world.
Friends and relatives of the victims have been expressing relief over the arrest, but the pain is everlasting. Ethan's basketball coach and mentor, not surprised that he had defensive wounds.
I've tried not to think too much about the particulars of that night, but certainly Ethan was a protector, and he had everybody, you know, everyone that he cared about, he had their back.
There has been so much interest in this case that thousands of people have been tracking Koberger's transport from Pennsylvania all the way across the country back here to the Pullman, Moscow area. Ashley?
Nancy Liu, a patient woman. Thank you for that. She's been waiting there all day. I want to bring in now Duncan Levin. He is a former federal prosecutor and criminal defense attorney who has represented high-profile clients like Anna Delvey, Harvey Weinstein, and Claire Bronfman. Also joining me is Mike King, a 28-year veteran of law enforcement in Utah. He's also the co-chair of the FBI's Violent Criminal Apprehension Program and former director of the Cold Case Unit. And John Muffler is a former U.S. Marshal who's escorted thousands of prisoners in transit and now owns a security consulting company. And John, I'm going to start with you on this one. I was a little surprised about the two stops that, you know, happened on this cross-country trip. I'm still trying to figure out if it is a coincidence or if this might have been, you know, local authorities working with the feds, either to slow them down because they may have lost the tail or to see if they could get a better read on whether this was still the suspect they were following. Did you make anything of it other than coincidence?
Are we talking about when he got pulled over in the vehicle?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The two stops.
So, yeah, I think it's coincidental. However, I would say it wouldn't be, it's plausible that the FBI had asked the Indiana police officer or police to pull that vehicle over to confirm the identity of the driver. It's possible. I don't know that. I know that's being bandied about on social media and the internet, but so that's possible. I think it's very much more coincidental because it is a tactic that law enforcement does use in the event, you know, they want to confirm somebody.
But what a weird tactic to pull them over twice within an hour. If I were Brian, I might have smelled a rat and started really trying to, you know, hide my tracks. It's surprising. Duncan, what's the status now in terms of speed? How fast, now that they've taken him from the plane and probably, you know, got him into booking at that little tiny jail that houses only about 42 prisoners or so, what's the status? How fast will they get him before a judge? How fast before those families can actually go into that courtroom and see the man who's accused of killing their kids?
I think we're going to probably see something tomorrow, if not within the next 48 hours. I mean, the next stop here is for him to get arraigned on these charges and for the probable cause affidavit to be both given to him and unsealed. It's possible that the defense has already gotten it and that it won't actually be unsealed until there's some sort of formal court. Obviously, there's no night court, so there'll probably be some kind of proceeding tomorrow, if not on Friday at the latest at this point. And I think it's highly likely that at that point, the probable cause affidavit is going to be unsealed and given to the public. And I think people should remember that not only are there rules about pretrial publicity and the lawyers won't be speaking much, the probable cause affidavit is going to be pretty bare bones. The prosecution does not want to lay out the entire case. They don't want to lay out all of the evidence. They're going to try to make this as bare bones as possible, just enough to tell everybody what the charges are, just enough to satisfy the judge, the court, that this is the right guy, and also support his remand and continued detention in the jail facility. But they're not going to lay out the entire case. They don't want to give a roadmap to the defense at this point.
Yeah, no narrative of what happened in that house necessarily, but a lot more than we know at this point. At least some connection to this mystery name, Brian Koberger. You know, heretofore, we'd never imagined a student in a PhD program in criminology at a neighboring university who seemed to have no connection. So at least we'll get something to take us to, you know, a probable cause for an arrest. Mike, go back to the planes for a minute. That we saw this today, an airplane circling for 2 hours. Let me ask the control room if we can get that video up, because I am mesmerized by it. 2 hours of circling above the Koberger's home. And make no mistake, that is exactly where the Koberger's home is. And for 2 hours, you can see the other planes flying past, flying around. That one is there for a reason. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I wonder if that's just a drone that they put up to keep track of the area. I don't know that it would be a manned aircraft, because like you mentioned, Ashley, I think the sound would have alerted people to the presence of it. And, you know, we have drone capability now that can fly for hours. So I suspect that was providing surveillance, hopefully,
but
streaming down.
I thought the same thing, Mike. And then I thought, hold it. Drones aren't on flight trackers. Like, they're not necessarily, you know, they're not necessarily going to be on these kinds of websites, are they?
Yeah, well, the larger drones will, because they need to be depending on the airspace that they're occupying. And so we see those larger aircraft flying at much higher elevations, and that one circling is probably at a lower elevation, but still has to be certified. It still has to be reported to the FAA that it's going to be up and occupying that bit of airspace. And I'm not a drone expert, but I am a pilot, so I know that that those things are flying around, and you have to worry about that level of airspace that they're in, and it's going to occupy a much lower space, above 400 feet.
You surprise me every time you're on. I didn't know you were a pilot. I had to come to you right out of the gate to ask that. Thank you for that. It's excellent information. But I find it even more fascinating that they had eyes on him like that from above for 2 hours late at night. You know, this is about 10 o'clock till midnight local time. And then it was about 6 hours later that the raid happened. Just so intriguing. Hey, Mike King, John Muffler, Duncan Levin, thank you, all three of you. Going to have you all back for certain. Appreciate your wisdom. Coming up, the main event, legally speaking, the state of Idaho versus Brian Christopher Koberger. We are months away from the actual trial, probably actually years, but a steady stream of evidence is sure to shock and awe each time some of it comes to light. And after a break, two top lawyers look ahead to the legal mountain that Brian Koberger is about to climb. And if the death penalty isn't lurking in the abyss, stay with us. All right, so these images came in within the last hour. You're looking at pictures in Pullman, Washington, about 10 minutes away from Moscow, Idaho, and the guy in orange is probably none too pleased to be there. He's being escorted in leg shackles and handcuffs and probably a big warm winter coat from an airplane that brought him all the way across the country from Pennsylvania, loaded into that vehicle for the short drive to the county courthouse and the jail, because they're the same building in Moscow, Idaho. But he'll be fingerprinted and processed and put into the Moscow County Jail. That's where he's going to spend his first night tonight. Probably get a change of clothes, too, because those crimson jail garb, they're from Pennsylvania. He's about to get the uniform for the jailbirds in Idaho. That's where he is. Anyway, these pictures coming into us as he landed live in a very small aircraft, a single engine aircraft, only holds 11 people, had to stop twice along the way to refuel. It's why it took almost, well, gosh, more than a full day. And he left his cell this morning at about 6 in the morning. Didn't get in till about, let's see, 9:20-ish Eastern time. So that's a 15-hour day of travel. Not comfortable, not meant to be comfortable. And those men that you see surrounding him, they're not comfortable either. They're not friends. They are escorts. Some of them may be air marshals. Some of them may be U.S. marshals, rather. Some of them may be FBI. Some may be Pennsylvania authorities. Others, Idaho authorities. But those are the people who escort people like Brian Koberger, who are accused quadruple murderers. It is more likely that he was the only inmate on that flight. And it is also entirely likely they did not take those leg shackles off ever. Even when they let him get off the plane and the two stops to go to the bathroom in those two small airports where they refueled. But there you go. That's what it looks like when you bring an accused killer across the country to face justice in a small rural town. This is Pullman, Washington. That's where he was going to school at the Washington State University, studying criminology, hope to be a PhD in it. Doubt that'll happen now. Or if it does, it'll probably happen behind bars. In any case, the short drive was only about 10 minutes or so, 10, 15 minutes to get to the jail where he was processed and where he'll be housed. So Koberger's first appearance is going to be in that same building, and it could come as soon as tomorrow. It's not a long walk, right? Just upstairs. It should tell us a whole lot more than the investigators have said so far about how and why they zeroed in on him. Why this guy for those horrible murders? But from this point forward, state and local authorities are not going to be the only ones calling the shots. Koberger will have a highly capable defense team led by the chief public defender of a nearby county who once got a murder conviction overturned after catching a police officer in a falsehood. She's going to be looking for police missteps and mistakes at every single turn. And by law, she's going to see every bit of prosecution evidence long before it ever shows up in a courtroom and you and I get to see it. I want to talk about all of this now with lawyers that I would not want to have to face if I were sitting at the opposing table on trial. Mark Garagos is a defense attorney who's almost as well known as his clients. He's represented Michael Jackson, Winona Ryder, and Scott Peterson, to name three, and now co-hosts the podcast Beyond a Reasonable Doubt with Adam Carolla. We're also joined by Susan Filan, a former prosecutor for the state of Connecticut. Okay, Susan, when do the public defenders get to see what the state has, why they think that this quadruple killer is Brian Koberger?
Well, first, obviously, they're going to get to see the probable cause statement tomorrow. But Ashley, I think you're going to be very disappointed. I think it's going to be very bare bones. It's not going to have a lot of meat on it. You're not going to get the whole story. I know you really want to know how did they get to him, and you'll get some inkling of that, but you're not going to see the whole case and all the evidence. So I think that's, I just want to prepare you for that if you're not prepared already. Then the defense is going to file motions, and the prosecution has to respond to those motions affirmatively, has to give them the evidence that they have, but they don't have to give them everything that they have all at once. They have to give what they have as it's prepared and as it's ready. And it's very possible that there are lab reports, expert evidence that isn't ready yet and won't be ready for quite some time. But a trial isn't a hide-the-ball game. It isn't trial by ambush. The prosecution does have to disclose the evidence, including exculpatory evidence, meaning anything that would point to his exoneration or his acquittal.
Okay, well, Mark Garagos, want to fit this in before the break.
The last comment is the
Oh, you're going to answer before I ask a question? Exactly. Are you going to do that? Let me ask a question. Hold on, Garagos. My goodness.
Brady. Yes.
Honored. Breach. You rarely get the Brady without having to go in there and extract their wisdom teeth. And by the
Let's wait on terms. Brady, our viewers need to know what Brady is before you guys just start having a legal fight here, okay? First of all, what I need to know from you is, are we going to find out in the probable cause affidavit where the actual DNA came from in the house, how they connect that to the actual person that they arrested? And I've got only 30 seconds before the break.
Yes, I think we are going to learn that. And I would bet already that since they had an expert in the house today and yesterday, that they already have the affidavit, which is one of the reasons that they made a rather bold statement about he wants to exonerate himself. I think that that tells you there isn't a whole lot that's in that affidavit, number one. And number two, it would be professional, a misstep for them to send their expert in there on blood splatter and everything else if they didn't already have the affidavit. And that's also, I'm going to speculate as to why they made what we call a gag order.
Okay, so listen, I have to fit the break in because we've had so much breaking news. I want you both to stick around, though, because we have a lot more to talk about. Been a long time since I've been doing this business of covering trials, and there is just nothing like a roll tape moment in a courtroom. It's like a modern-day Perry Mason moment. Jury sits up, everybody pays attention. Susan Filon and Mark Garagos back with me. And I want to just show you some of these pictures that have been rolling in. News Nation getting the pictures of the motorcade coming in with Brian Koberger as he rolls into Moscow, Idaho, to be booked into the Moscow, Idaho jail. Dinky little jail, 42 or so inmates in there. Not the kind of place you're going to stay a long time, but it is the kind of place where when your plane rolls in and you face four murder charges, first degree in Idaho, it's where you're going to be at least processed before you go before that magistrate or that judge and hear the charges against you. From Pennsylvania and the green suicide smock to whatever it is they're issuing him in Idaho. Okay, so I want to go back to Mark Garagos and Susan Filon. Guys, the body cam video is so critical because it shows a total party scene at that house, and that's what defense attorneys will always seize on. There were so many people in that house, maybe even Brian Koberger. Is that what you see, Mark Garagos? That's what they're going to use?
Well, clearly, if they've got DNA in that location, one of the places they're going to have to decide or tell or reveal is where did the criminalist get it? Well, that was one of the reasons they sent in, well, amongst others, a expert yesterday to take a look, to photograph, to take the scene before they did anything to it. If it turns out that it's a mixture and with others, then there, it's a very tough road to hoe for the prosecution, because you then show videos of noise complaints, of body cams that have shown that there were parties there that were frequented by a lot of college students. You then know, as you've mentioned already, okay, it's a very short drive between the two colleges.
10 seconds left. I'm so tight for time, but Susan Filon, he said, have you arrested anyone else when they got him in the jail in Pennsylvania? Real quick comment on that. Was he sowing seeds?
You know, look, I think that he planned, first of all, he's presumed innocence, but he planned the case in terms of the committing the crime, and he planned the case in terms of the arrest and the prosecution. So all these little things that he's saying, I think he's playing both sides of the game. He's trying to say, catch me if you can as the person who committed the crime, and catch me as you can as the person who has to go to trial and defend these charges.
Susan Filon and Mark Garagos, I wish I had more time for you. It's just that there's been so much breaking news, and it continues to break, too. So thank you. I'm going to have both of you back in the meantime. After the break, our Brian Enten is miking up. He's outside the jail. He's got some breaking news. We're going to have it in just a couple of minutes. Back after this. Live right back out to Moscow, Idaho. Brian Enten is standing by live outside of the local jail there, where just within the last hour and a half, a very famous inmate showed up. Brian, take me to the process now, whether he's been booked and everything that's happened with Brian Koberger since that motorcade showed up behind you.
Yeah, it was so crazy, Ashley. You saw everything that happened about an hour ago, and now it's very, very quiet. He is now inside the jail. The booking process behind the scenes is happening. I told you earlier, this is a small jail. I mean, it's a little jail underneath the courthouse, so this is certainly a situation that they're not used to in terms of someone this high profile, but they're rolling with it. I mean, we were told that he's going to be in solitary confinement. You know, when he was in Pennsylvania, he's vegan, so they were accommodating his vegan meal requests, and we're told that the sheriff is going to try to do the same thing here. So that'll certainly be interesting. But you see that video there? That's the motorcade that arrived, came right through the streets of Moscow. Before that, the plane landed at Pullman Moscow Airport, which is about 15 minutes from here. Touchdown. They drove him here, and then the whole process is over tonight.
Yeah, I'm looking at just a sea of people, but I'm guessing many of them, or most or all of them, are media. However, you telling me that they drove through Moscow makes me think that a lot of people in that town have a vested interest in seeing this process through and might actually have come out to the jail to be a part of this, to witness, you know, the arrival of this much sought after suspect. Were there people who came from the university or from the town?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you're right. It was a lot of media, but there were a lot of people from town just standing around. And I saw that at the airport, too. People drove in, parked in the parking lot. They wanted to catch a glimpse of him. You know, they're angry. I mean, this has taken over their town. This isn't what they want to be known for. We've been here for a month. This is a beautiful, small, quaint town that hasn't had a murder in years. And they're angry at this man. And now he's back. And many people just wanted to catch a glimpse of him.
Did anyone yell? You know, oftentimes press will yell questions like, did you do it? And why did you do it? Even though he's the suspect only and he's got the presumption of innocence. But did any people make a reference or yell at him? Or was there a reaction from them that you could see from locals who showed up?
I didn't see anyone yelling at him. You know, at the airport, there was a couple of locals standing by me, but we were so far away. Luckily, our cameraman was able to zoom in, but where they parked the plane, you couldn't get down to it. So even if you yelled there, I mean, there was, it was windy. There's no way that he would hear. And it was pretty quiet here, too. I think people were just kind of quiet and watching and, you know, just trying to sort of see what his mannerisms were like. You know, when I saw him in Pennsylvania, we were closer. We were able to yell questions at him that he clearly heard. He sort of turned. I told you last night he turned and glanced over at us, but has never really made any comments at anyone that's yelled.
And then just quick question about all the people who showed up with him. I mean, that was a heck of a motorcade for one person, granted, a very high profile and potentially dangerous inmate if he's, you know, guilty of the things he's accused of. But what about all those people? Did you get a glimpse? Was it U.S. Marshals? Was it FBI? Did they get him to the front door of the jail and then head back to the jet or back to the single prop plane?
Well, you know, I was thinking about that. You've got these people who came from Pennsylvania. We know there was at least one FBI agent on the plane. It was a small plane, and the day they've had, I mean, it started at 6 a.m., Ashley, in Pennsylvania, and they were on that plane that took like 10 hours to get across the country with all those stops. So I'm assuming they're going to spend the night here and just rest up a little bit before they head back to Pennsylvania. But it was a big crowd with him. Like I said, some FBI were hearing, you know, that the marshals initially offered to help with the transport, but that didn't happen. I'm interested in the backstory in all of this because, again, I just think it's interesting that it was the Pennsylvania State Police single engine plane that took him all the way from Pennsylvania across the country. I think there's going to be more to that that comes out at some point.
So one quick question. I've only got about 40 seconds left, but where you are, it's a basement of cells. I think they can only hold about 42 inmates. And then he literally just has to come upstairs for a court appearance. So that could happen first thing, you know, as gavel comes down, 9 a.m. Oh, is that? Wait, you know what? We've got his first booking photo on the screen, Brian. This is his first booking photo after landing in Moscow, Idaho, at the Moscow, Idaho jail. He is now out of that burgundy jumpsuit from Pennsylvania and into the orange, you know, prison t-shirt, or jail t-shirt from Moscow. 10 seconds left. Just give me a quick answer to that logistics answer, if you could.
Yeah, I'm just seeing this picture for the first time, too. I'm looking at it. Just goes upstairs. Again, I mean, if you're from a big city, this is going to be sound very strange to you, but the jail's underneath the little courthouse, and he gets walked up, and it's just that easy here.
Wow. How about that? You're going to see that picture a lot. Brian Enten, just excellent reporting as usual. Thank you for that. Brian's live outside of that jail facility where that photo was just snapped and was just released to the rest of us. And I got to tell you something. All too often, the victims of these crimes and their devastated families get overlooked because of these booking photos and the flights and the chase and the search. And those people get forgotten in the rush for justice on behalf of their loved ones. Just take a look at these pictures. This one we saw today. One of the victims, Zenica Nodal, this was posted online by a friend. She's outside spinning and has a huge smile on her face. She's just loving life. One commenter below the post summed it up beautifully by saying, "What an exquisite, joyful moment. I will think of this every time I see or hear Zana's name." And tonight, we want to do something else. We don't want to talk about Brian for a second here. We want to remember the four innocent people at the heart of a story that we've been covering for more than 7 weeks now. The lives that were cut short on that dark November morning in Moscow, Idaho.
Only when I lie in bed on my own.
Anyone who knew Kaylee would tell you the same thing. To know her was to love her. Her love for life and everyone in it was so inspiring. She made it a priority to make everyone feel so important and so loved.
There was never a day that she didn't want to race her brother because she was just determined that girls were faster than boys. Or that she didn't want to go bug her little sisters.
Favorite memory for me was watching the game with her, and every time the Steelers scored, I'd pick her up and I told her high in the air.
I didn't really realize that I was in love with Maddie until the summer of 2020. We went to McCall and spent a lot of time on the water. We floated the river and just hung out every chance we got.
They went to other countries together. Karen took them to Hawaii together. We took them to Mexico together. They went to college together. They went to high school together. They lived in their own apartment together. They were sisters.
She was so positive and lighthearted and understood the gift of life more than anyone I know. I remember her getting so mad at me for caring about the little things that didn't matter. She would always tell me she wouldn't know what to do without me, and now I have to live this life without her.
And she taught me a lot of stuff. She taught me how to be a dad. And I didn't know that until she was gone, you know?
Santa, you will not be forgotten. You have impacted so many lives and have given people so much love. I hope I can make you proud and try to leave an impact on this world and on people like you did.
He had such an infectious smile and a charismatic personality. And if you knew anything about Xana as well, they were very similar in how they acted together.
They were always so happy, and the way she would talk and smile about him was something I've never seen her do before. She truly loved him so much, and I know he had so much love for her.
We are eternally grateful that we spent so much time with him. And I want to remind you that that's the most important message that we have for you and your families, is to make sure that you spend as much time as possible with those people, because time is precious and it's something you can't get back.
Have shared memories of their daughters and the son they lost. Xana Kernodle's sister Jasmine posted this essay written by Xana for a class in October, just a month before she died. The assignment: to write about an object of value, and she chose a pair of black Converse sneakers that she got in freshman year of high school. This is what she wrote. Where I live off campus, everyone throws an old pair of shoes on the telephone wire by their house when they move out. It signifies the time we spend in these off-campus houses, but for me, it'll signify the past 8 years of my life, and I'll be throwing these shoes on the telephone wire next year when I graduate, and I already know it's going to be a liberating feeling. She did not live to do that, and we are hoping that family or friends will do that for her. We will see you again.